And welcome to The Dividing Line on, Thursday, December 26th, 2013. Wrapping up the year, it's that day after all of the festivities, so on and so forth. Start looking toward the new year, making plans, resolutions, all that kind of stuff. And we just simply continue on with the work of the ministry. Want to start off today, if I could find, I've got so many different audio note taker things on my screen right now. There it is. Want to start off today with something I promised to play for you earlier. It is an illustration in my mind of what's going on in the world today when it comes to our society and what we consider to be wisdom. I truly believe that the thought processes of especially the younger generation have been so diminished and degraded by a secular worldview, and hence the only type of education that a secular worldview can give, that people are now impressed by the most shallow forms of thinking. And of course, they get very angry. Oh, you're just very arrogant. If you say anyone's thought process is shallow, but there are shallow thought processes. And when people engage in them and hence engage in foolish behavior, that's the stuff of comedy. But when the left is pushing it and the secularists are pushing it, then it's the things of wisdom. A few weeks ago on that great bastion of progression, and by the way, progressive, what a wonderful word. Everyone wants to progress, right? However, when you drive a car over a cliff, it is progressing. It's just progressing downward. It's the final destination. Everything's always progressing toward a final destination. The question is whether that's an upward destination or a downward destination. And so, HuffPo, the Huffington Post, a wonderful, progressive outpost of all things foolish and idiotic at times, had a video of a young man at his bar mitzvah. And it's actually on YouTube somewhere. I don't have that up. I grabbed the MP3 and that's what I'm going to play for you. But it was being promoted as this great wisdom and the brilliance of this young man. And he does speak well. But the problem is his name's Duncan. And here you have the result of raising a child without a meaningful, transcendent moral and ethical worldview. He's giving his bar mitzvah talk, and he starts with a section from the Torah, demonstrates what should have been a corrected misunderstanding of that particular text. And then, because at his young age, his parents have exposed him to all sorts of same-sex attraction and relationships, and he has developed friendships within this context, he confuses friendship with someone with the necessary approval of their behavior and the things that they want to do. And in the process, ends up just, again, just completely buying into this marriage equality lie. And it is a lie. He doesn't believe in marriage equality. He thinks he does, but no one evidently will challenge him on this issue or explain to him where he has gone wrong. And instead, you have adults applauding him, the adults who should take the young man aside, who themselves should recognize the fundamental logical error in what he's saying. But unfortunately, I don't hear very many people doing that at all. In fact, it does seem that the majority of our fellow citizens have either accepted the argument, or if they haven't accepted the argument, they don't know why they don't accept the argument. The reason why the phrase marriage equality is utter foolishness could be illustrated by speaking of driving equality. You see, driving requires specific capacities. my granddaughter's with us right now. Family's in from Georgia. And I would identify as abjectly foolish anyone who would allow my granddaughter to drive. All right? Why? She can see probably better than I can. And her arms and her legs work just fine. Her ears work fine. But we do not allow her to drive. Why not? Because the term driving has particular connotations and skill sets and capacities that are a part of the very word itself. And the only way you can change that is to redefine driving. Driving requires a knowledge of law, and you may not be able to identify the mathematical formulations, but you need to have the capacity to do some physics. Did you know that? Sure. It's called depth perception. It's called stopping your car before it runs into the other guy's car. Recognizing that two moving bodies hitting each other causes physical damage. There are certain capacities necessary for the activity of driving. And therefore, we don't have an equality in driving movement. Now, here in Arizona, there is sort of something like that going on. There was a story just this morning. You know, why not give driver's licenses to people who aren't actually supposed to legally be here? That kind of thing. All right. So you got that kind of thing. But that's a little different. We're talking about there's something about driving that limits the participants in driving. So my granddaughter should not be allowed to drive yet. Eventually, she will be allowed to drive. What that means is that words have meanings, and to redefine words is not actually to communicate in a meaningful fashion. And so when we talk about driving equality, there are other people who can see just fine, but they lack the ability to control their limbs, or they may lack limbs. We don't allow them to drive. They can't. Or let's put it another way, there are people who have perfectly functioning limbs, but they can't see. Their sight no longer exists. Should there be a driving equality for the blind? Should the blind be allowed to drive? For their sake and everybody else's? No. There's a certain level of mental capacity that is required. People who are mentally incapacitated. We shouldn't let them drive. I think that actually we let way too many of them drive, but they somehow managed to convince the authorities that they could. So the point is, to talk about driving equality is foolishness. Now, the term equality, oh, we all like that. But it's foolishness when it requires the utter redefinition of the first word, which would be driving. The same thing when you attach equality to marriage. Marriage has a meaning. And you can determine the meaning of that word by turning it into a verb and looking at its direct object. So, I married Kelly. Now, there is meaning in the word marry. And there is meaning, resultant meaning, in my relationship to her and her relationship to me as a result of that action of being married. She becomes my wife. I become her husband. Husband and wife have particular meanings, and there is no woman who can ever be a husband and no man who can ever be a wife. Those words have meaning. To redefine them destroys the fundamental relationship. Same thing with father and mother, husband and wife. They are gender specific and they are gender good. It is right, it is proper, it is moral, it is good, it is superior to recognize that gender has to do with those words. It is evil, wrong, depraved, and disgusting to remove gender from those words. That's a fact. It's a fact that every person I'm listening to knows in their heart, even if they are suppressing that knowledge. So when you talk about marriage equality, you're doing the exact same thing that I just did with driving equality. And that is by redefining it, by changing it to two men, two women, three women, one man, 10 women, one man, one woman, 10 men, whatever, which is what we are faced with now. You have destroyed the institution by changing the meaning of language. Someone should take little Duncan aside and explain to him that while it sounds real good, it sounds real nice to talk about marriage equality, it is an absurdity. Because you are redefining the words. You can use other words. Flying equality. We should all have the ability to fly. Well, I can't. I'm not built to. A bird can. They're built to do that. I'm not built to do that. There's something about the activity that delimits the participants. And marriage is between a man and a woman. There are subforms of marriage that have been between one man and multiple women, but that's always brought heartache in the history of man. And what he's going to do is he's going to point out there's polygamy in the Old Testament, and therefore what that means, of course, is that the definition of marriage changes. And what he misses is even in polygamy, it's still heterosexual. You still have a husband, you still have a wife. It's not the highest form. It's always a step down. But it's still heterosexual. And so those who push this marriage equality are simply having to count on the moral stupidity of the audience to not catch the same kind of redefinition of terms that used car salesmen use to get around the defects in what they're trying to sell you. And that's what we've got going on. And so here you have a young man. I'm sure he has the highest of intentions. I hold accountable the adults who should have been able to explain the problem. Let's listen to what he had to say.
Shabbat shalom.
Shabbat shalom.
In my Torah portion, Vayetzeh, Jacob works for 7 years to earn the right to marry Laban's daughter, his love, Rachel. Before marrying Rachel, Jacob is first tricked into marrying her older sister, Leah. I find my parasha interesting because it is a window into what life was like back in the days of the Torah. Back then, they seemed to have a perfect definition of what traditional marriage meant for their time, when as time passes, we have a completely different definition today. So the question is, how has the definition of traditional marriage changed since the days of the Torah? Just looking at my Torah portion as a proof text, I think it has changed a lot. Leah and Rachel had absolutely no say in marrying Jacob. It was like a business deal between Jacob and Laban. Today, in the United States, marriage is very different. No longer do the fathers arrange marriages, and women can marry whomever they want. While studying my Torah portion and comparing and contrasting marriage in the past and present, I found it would be irresponsible to exclude the topic of gay marriage. I am a very, very strong supporter of equal rights and the freedom of men and women to marry whomever they love. People who disagree with me like to quote the Bible and say that traditional marriage should be between only one man and one woman.
Notice the heterosexual nature of that.
But as you see in my Torah portion that I've just read, the definition of traditional marriage is nothing like what people think it is today.
Well, there you have one problem in not recognizing Jesus as the Son of God who interprets those texts in Matthew chapter 19. But notice the young man seems to miss the heterosexual element of it all.
Jacob married two sisters who were his first cousins. In the U.S., the movement toward marriage equality has taken a significant step forward this year. As of now, 15 states plus the District of Columbia have the freedom to marry same-sex couples. On October 18th, here in Oregon, state agencies decided they must recognize same-sex marriages that are performed in other states, even though, sadly, Oregon still does not allow same-sex marriage to be performed in our own state. According to OregonMarriageEquality.com, Oregon currently has a ban between same-sex partners. The domestic partnership law affords some of the same rights as marriage, but still is not equal in name or benefits. While putting rights up to a vote is never fair, marriage equality will hopefully make it to the Oregon ballot in 2014. This subject is not only interesting, but it's also very personal.
Now, notice the use of the term rights. Rights. This is a rights issue. No, it's not. It's a definition issue. It has nothing to do with rights. Every male homosexual could marry a woman if he wanted to. Every lesbian can marry a man if she wanted to. They just don't want to. So it has nothing to do with rights at all. And by shifting the topic, shifting the attention, it's amazing the success that people have had, which only shows, again, that the constituency in the West is made up today of people who have been taught what to think and not how to think. That's frightening. That kind of populace is what ends up being under the control of despots, because they've not been taught how to think. They cannot critically analyze what is said to them. When people like Justin Bieber are giving direction to the moral compass of a society, that society is on its last legs, at least in any moral sense.
My family is very close friends with many same-sex couples, especially Joel and David and Jeff and Wade. They have influenced me to go to Prop 8 rallies when I lived in California to support the freedom to marry, and they are wonderful people, wonderful parents, and wonderful couples. I was at Joel and David's first wedding in California a number of years ago, and it was beautiful. I say first wedding because these two courageous men have gotten married in three different states in which same-sex marriage is legal, and I hope they'll continue until they are married in all 50 states.
That was about six people.
They are here to celebrate my bar mitzvah with me, along with their awesome son, Estuardo.
And where did he come from? He didn't come from that union. Oh, no, he didn't. That union can never produce children. It can't. It can't produce life. It's not possible. It's against nature. That child had to come from someplace else.
I am proud to be part of a congregation that is 100% in support of same-sex marriage. All clergy have spoken in support of freedom to marry and are very involved in the Oregon campaign. The congregation formally endorsed the November 2014 ballot initiative and is actively working on the Oregon campaign to allow all Oregonians the freedom to marry.
No, they're not. No, they're not. All Oregonians the freedom to marry? They're not pushing. Are they pushing for the freedom for gay brothers to marry? Mothers to marry their sons, fathers their daughters, fathers their sons, mothers their daughters? No, they're not. So they're bigots, right? It has nothing to do with rights. It has nothing to do with freedom. It has to do with redefinition. It has to do with redefinition. Knocking down the walls, destroying the institution. That's what it's all about.
Torah portion taught me that the definition of traditional marriage has changed a lot since the days of the Torah. So why can't it change just a little bit more so everybody can marry who they love? And now that I'm a bar mitzvah, I will not only continue to support, but encourage other people to support equal marriage rights. Shabbat shalom.
Shabbat shalom.
So that's what was posted on the Huffington Post website with glowing, oh, isn't this awesome? The wisdom of the children. You know, I start wanting to sing something from John Denver, you know, the wisdom of the children, they'll lead us into, yeah, blah, blah, blah. Again, Duncan has been, his parents have decided to put him in a context where that's all he knows. That's all he knows. And so he thinks that's a good thing. And this is why, you know, I've thought of that description that Paul provides of people in the last days deceiving and being deceived. So there are people who are deceiving others, but the vast majority of them are deceived themselves. Deception begets further deception. If you don't love the truth, you cause to love a lie. And that's what we see all around us. That's what we see all around us. In another item here, I saw an article on December 19th, and it was titled, What You Believe About Homosexuality Doesn't Matter, by Tyler, intheparlor.wordpress.com. And here's what he says. Today, there are two news stories that have been circulating all over my Facebook and Twitter news feeds. One you're probably aware of, the other maybe not. The two, though, are closely related. The first news story is the indefinite suspension of Duck Dynasty star Phil Robertson due to the comments he made during an interview with GQ magazine. The second news story is about the defrocking of Pennsylvania UMC pastor Frank Schaefer after he performed the marriage for his gay son and subsequent refusal to submit to church law regarding his action. The link between these two stories is clear. The church's views, or in this case of Duck Dynasty, a certain understanding of the Christian faith's views regarding homosexuality. The reaction to both of these stories has been emphatic, to say the least. The debate over the rightness or wrongness of homosexuality has once again been fired up. The appeals to the biblical passages have been made. The academic rebuttals, the interpretation of those passages has no doubt been referenced. Well, notice immediately you can tell where this person's coming from. There is an academic rebuttal to the interpretation of those passages. We've all seen what happens when the revisionists actually try to come into the debate arena. This is not a statement of arrogance. This is a statement of fact. I've never lost a debate against a homosexual or anyone promoting homosexuality. And I don't think there's anybody who would say that I have. I cannot imagine anyone saying that John Shelby Spong won our debate on homosexuality. And Barry Lynn's response, of trying to sue us, threatening to sue us to suppress the tapes of our debate with him, pretty clear indication of what he thought happened in that debate on homosexuality, too. And I debated a homosexual in Salt Lake City. Justin Lee didn't even want to use the term debate of our encounter just earlier this year. We haven't gotten into 2014 yet. So I've not lost a debate on this subject. Nor should I lose a debate on this subject in any way, shape, or form. As long as you know the facts, as long as you know the issues, there shouldn't be an issue at all. So the revisionists can try, but the revisions don't work when placed in the context of someone who can demonstrate the reality. The calls for freedom and tolerance from both sides have been shouted, or at least typed out with great gusto. The theological debate, and I'm using that term very generously here, has been raging all day long and no doubt will continue to rage in the weeks to come. But I refuse to engage in it the way I see in it. The way I see it, the time for that debate has long since passed. Now, this man is a youth pastor. But he is a youth pastor in the United Methodist Church. Now, I know there are still believers in UMC, but you've got to admit, folks, you are in the small minority. I mean, let's face it, on an institutional level, your denomination hit the capitulation button a long time ago when it came to biblical authority. Look at Claremont Graduate School. Just look at your leadership, and I'm sorry, Episcopalians, United Methodist Church, Liberal Presbyterians, you're all in the same very rapidly shrinking boat, and it's rapidly sinking boat, too. So he says, but I refuse to engage in it. The way I see it, the time for that debate has long since passed. The stakes are too high now. Like, now listen to this. The stakes are too high for what? Theological debate. The current research suggests that teenagers that are gay are about 3 times more likely to attempt suicide than their heterosexual peers. That puts the percentage of gay teens attempting suicide at about 30-some percent. 1 out of 3 teens who are gay or bisexual try to kill themselves, and a lot of times they succeed. In fact, Reverend Schaefer's son contemplated suicide on a number of occasions in his teens. Now, if we just stopped right there, rationally, logically, in a world where common sense still existed in the public sphere, what would that mean? That would mean that homosexuality is a bad thing. That it's bad for people. It brings death. It's not natural. It would be immediately identified as the problem. But that's not how it's identified as the problem here. It's not identified as a problem here. The problem is everybody else. Where did common sense go? What's going on here? I mean, it's like, okay, teenagers who abuse crack cocaine frequently experience death in many different bad ways. Drugs destroy the body. Right? And so what do we blame? The drugs? No, we should blame our condemnation of drugs. If we didn't blame drugs, then they'd be good for you. What? So if you don't condemn homosexuality, if you just say it's great and wonderful, then everybody will be fine. What? Fact of the matter is, it doesn't matter. I'm going back to reading the thing here. The fact of the matter is, it doesn't matter whether or not you think homosexuality is a sin. Let me say it again. It does not matter if you think homosexuality is a sin or if you think it is simply another expression of human love. It doesn't matter. Bold and italics, which ends the argument right there. Once you use bold italics, if it was underlined in blue and if it blinked, remember blink, the HTML tag blink. We had blink. We had blink back in the, what was that, about 1994, something like that. 96, 7, 8? Okay, all right, thanks. Okay, stop. We don't want to embarrass ourselves. Why doesn't it matter? Because people are dying. Kids are literally killing themselves because they're so tired of being rejected and dehumanized. They feel their only option left is to end their life. Now look, this grabs people by the heart. But think about it. How many pedophiles kill themselves? Ooh, that's huge. That's huge. So let's say pedophilia is just an expression of love. See the problem? Oh, you're saying all homosexuals are pedophiles. See, it's amazing the incapacity of the leftist mind to stay on one line for very long. There is an argument here. If you don't have an objective moral standard that defines human behavior in a meaningful fashion, you're going to have real problems discussing these things. He says, as a youth pastor, this makes me physically ill. And as a human, it should make you feel the same way. So I'm through with the debate. Who cares what God says? Who cares about theology? This is why the UMC will die. Will die. Because it's filled with unbelievers. This man has no concept of having God's revelation is the foundation that then determines the rest of his life. He's in the center. God's out here. Theology's out here. And he's decided this thing can just go away. This is secularism with a religious layer on it. When faced with the choice between being theologically correct, as if this is even possible, there you go. There's the UMC. Yea, has God said. And being morally responsible, as if you could define that without the first part. I'll go with morally responsible every time. Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a German pastor and theologian during World War II. He firmly held the theological position of nonviolence. He believed that complete pacifism was theologically correct, and yet in the midst of the war, he conspired to assassinate Adolf Hitler, to kill a fellow man. Why? Because in light of what he saw happening to the Jews around him by the Nazis, he felt it would be morally irresponsible not to. Between the assassination of Hitler and nonviolence, he felt the greatest sin would be nonviolence. We are past the time for the debate. No connection here. No connection here. Missed it. We no longer have the luxury to consider the original meaning of Paul's letter to the Corinthian church. That's what he said. We are past time for debate. We no longer have the luxury to consider the original meaning of the Paul's letters to the Corinthian church. Well, the original meaning is not really difficult to determine. We are now faced with the reality that there are lives at stake. God's glory, eternity, salvation, and the very human life itself. No. We just need to make sure that kids don't commit suicide. So whatever you believe about homosexuality, keep it to yourself. Instead, try telling a gay kid that you love him, you don't want him to die. Try inviting her into your church, into your home, and into your life. Anything other than that simply doesn't matter. Look, everyone can understand what the guy's saying, but he's speaking as a non-Christian. And you need to know how to respond to it. Because you see, when you bring a person who is addicted to drugs that will kill them into a situation where you will not in any way, shape, or form bring morality to bear, reality to bear, the fact this will kill you to bear, and just simply, you know, you're just accepted. You're just loved. Love does more than accept. And it's not life you're inviting them to. It's eternal death. This is a person created in the image of God. The reason they're contemplating suicide is that they are themselves tearing at that image of God. That's the whole point. Here is unbelieving Christianity. That's what it is. It's unbelieving Christianity, which means it's not Christianity at all. It's not Christianity at all. I have another one we'll look at later on from Charisma News on that one, but we've gone half an hour on that. And I needed to address some other issues. The shifting gears, the smoke that you smell is coming from the clutch. looking briefly at the Twitter feed, I just ignore what's there. Anyways, we move on. Last week, it was made known to me. Let me see if I can find it here. Where'd it go? There it is. In 2004, in, I believe, issue 81 of the Southern Baptist Theological Journal, an article appears titled "The Doctrine of Jihad in the Islamic Hadith," authors Emir F. Kanner and Ergun M. Kanner. And I was surprised to see this, had not seen it before last week sometime. I think it was sometime Thursday. It's an unbalanced article. It's a one-sided article. But the biggest concern that immediately caught my eye as I looked through it, footnote number one is a footnote to a lengthy portion. Let me see how many. On February 28th, 1998, five Islamic caliphates, and I'm not even sure why they're called caliphates, signed a document of a declaration of war against the United States of America, a fatwa, representing five radical factions. These men unite in calling the Muslim world to task against the perceived enemy of Islam. The full text reads as follows. I see 17 paragraphs. 17 paragraphs with a single footnote. And that single footnote reads, published in Arabic on February 23rd, 1998, in Al-Quds Al-Arabi. Then we have this sentence, translation and italics by the authors. Now, I suppose that phrase, that sentence, translation italics by the authors, could be taken ambiguously, but when it is found in a footnote in a theological journal, the authors, plural, are the authors of the article. That's the normative utilization of language. Now, we all know that Ergun Kanner hides behind non-normative utilization of language, or at least he and his sycophant defenders. But the normative utilization of that language, translation and italics by the authors, means that Ergun and Emir Kanner were claiming to have translated this from Arabic into English. The reason that's rather interesting, of course, is we all know that in the excuse sheet published by Norman Geisler, which has undergone an interesting weight reduction program since it was originally published. It's gotten smaller and smaller over time for some strange reason. But the original can still be found by web archive, web.archive.org. And in fact, even found in a PDF on the Veritas Seminary website. If you go to veritasseminary.com/edu/media/cannerdefenserev.pdf, Canner with a capital C, you will be able to bring up this PDF. I would save it while you can and save the URL, because we know that Eric and Canner has other sycophants listening to this program, watching the Twitter feeds, who are very busily seeking to cannerize everything they can. But here, even at the Veritas Seminary, which we very lovingly call Pravda Theological Seminary, because of its involvement in the great evangelical cover-up, you have the original, what looks like the original form of the excuse sheet, which, as we pointed out when it was originally published at normangeister.com, that it was, in fact, normangeister.com, that we looked in the subdirectory. It did not take any hacking to do that. It was publicly available. And those of us who, back in the early part of this century, did use that dinosaur program called Microsoft Front Page, knows that you can take a Word document and ask Front Page to turn it into HTML. The result, from an HTML perspective, was, what term should I use? Ugly. Very, very ugly.
The program is called Heavy.
Heavy.
Heavy with heavy. Too much code.
Heavy, very heavy. It's heavy, man. Very heavy. It was bad. Okay, it was ugly. It was bad. But the point is, whoever converted it didn't bother deleting the Word document out of the subdirectory. And so the Word document was fully downloadable. We downloaded it. You open it up. And in the properties in the Word document, it says that it was produced on a machine licensed to Truett McConnell College, which, of course, is where Emir Canner is president. And so there you go. There, the connection was made. We've posted the screenshots. It's all up there. This isn't Norman Geisler's writing. This is Emir Canner's writing, providing some of the most laughable, absurd, makes Gail Ripplinger look bright style material we've ever encountered. It's that bad. It is that bad. That's why we continue to go, what is that Hadith 2425 again? Because it's indefensible, absolutely indefensible. Norman Geisler will never defend it. Eric Canner, Emir Canner, nobody will ever defend it. I could open up the phone lines right now and say, send your best, and it'll be crickets. It's indefensible. It's absurd. I have enough sound files just within easy click to shred it. It's that bad. But it's still out there. The pared down version is still on Norman Geisler's website and on Veritas. Anyways, it is in that we read the following words. The charge that he could speak Arabic when he can't. He only claims to be able to speak Arabic the way most non-Arabic Muslims do. Although he was raised in Sweden by a Swedish mother, Ergun learned enough Arabic, as most Muslims do, to read the Quran and speak it in prayer. Now, again, even that is absurd on a level that is difficult. I mean, it's just chuckles. First of all, he wasn't raised in Sweden by a Swedish mother. I mean, when you ask where was I raised, well, I was born in Minneapolis, but I was only there for 5.5 years or so. I spent 6 years in Pennsylvania, and then the rest of the time in Arizona. Okay, so if you're only there till before age 3, you weren't raised in Sweden. You were born in Sweden, and you had a Swedish mother, which, of course, then gives the lie to us, I'm 100% Turkish. No, you're not. Not if you have a Swedish mother. That means you're 50% Turkish. Maybe he's just got a math issue. I don't know. But it says, Ergun learned enough Arabic, as most Muslims do, to read the Quran. Most Muslims cannot read the Quran in Arabic. Who are these people? Have they ever met a Muslim? And speaking in prayer. Well, yeah, the prayers are in Arabic. But the vast majority of Muslims, the world's Muslims, cannot read the Quran in Arabic. It's just baloney. But here is an admission he does not speak Arabic, even though he pretended to over and over and over again, as we demonstrated in the video. So if this is the case, then why is there a theological journal article still online available at sbts.edu? Go to the journal, go to the online resources, go to the journal, search for Cantor. It'll come up. It's from 2003. Why is this, this footnote's on page 41 of SBJT, underline 081, underline Cantor.pdf. Footnote number one, translation italics by the authors. Now we know that, not it, Turton fan Justin Channel right now just put up another link. Just put up another link, clicking. Aha! Here is one from the ETS, Evangelical Theological Society, meeting, annual national meeting, Colorado Springs, Colorado. Presented by Emir and Ergen. And, yep, look at that. Now, mine only goes page... Oh, that's page one. I wonder where page two goes. Let's... Would two be it? Yep, there it is. Yep, there it is. And footnote, translation italics by the authors. Okay, same claim being made. And that's in 2001. Yep, so they started this early. When did Emir learn to translate Arabic? Because we know that Ergen can't do it. And Emir's PhD is in the Anabaptists. So is he the one that can translate Arabic? When did he learn to do it? He wasn't. His exposure to his father's Islam is even less than Ergen's. He's the youngest. He was born in the United States. I've never heard him even claim to speak Arabic. So who translated this? And why is it some people in channel, some really smart people in channel, started looking around and they found this same document in English, and it's eerily the same as what's found in these papers. In fact, let's put it this way. It's a whole lot closer to being plagiarism than anything Mark Driscoll did. Interesting. Well, the discovery of this, and I'm looking at the footnotes here. I don't see any reference in the Baptist Theological Journal article that says that this article appeared or was presented at ETS and appeared earlier. I wonder why not. But then footnote number seven of the article says, see Hadith number 42, volume 4. This verse is also repeated in 5.59.602. Now again, that is not a meaningful citation of the Hadith collections. If you don't identify the collection, you can't find the reference. Anybody who's actually read the Hadith knows this. Anyone who's actually debated Muslims knows this. Ergen and Emir Cantor didn't know this. They've got to know it by now. But they didn't know this up until about 2010. Well, evidently, the discovery of the SBTS journal article caused somebody to look around and go, hey, I wonder if Ergen Cantor ever spoke at Southern Seminary. And lo and behold, he did. He did. At the Carl F.H. Henry get-together in 2003 with Dr. Moore and Dr. Moeller, the third speaker was Ergen Cantor. I will try to remember to post the URLs to the original MP3s. They are still available at sbts.edu, and I hope and pray they remain available at sbts.edu so that you can listen. But, of course, we've downloaded them. The web doesn't forget. The web doesn't forget. And I listened to them last week, and there were a couple places where I just about fell off my bike. One of them I think I already played for you last time. I'm going to play it early here, and then we'll get back to it. Here you have, from 2003, here's to me one of the most important elements of the discovery of these audios. Now, by the way, this would have been really interesting because Peter Kreeft was supposed to be there as well, and they were going to be critiquing his evangelical jihad. But he never made it. And they're still not exactly sure why. It was some sort of alleged... Well, the assertion was a family emergency, but no one ever said what it was. So Kreeft wasn't there. Thankfully, Dr. Mohler's presentation was, as with most things that Dr. Mohler does, smack dab on target. In the midst of this, I heard something that made me go, huh? And that is, at some point in here, I didn't mark it, but at some point in here, and I've been able to verify this since then, Ergen Kanner at this time was a trustee of Southern Seminary. He was elected to that point. He elected that position by the Southern Baptist Convention in the state of Colorado, I believe, where he was at that time a pastor or had been a pastor. He was a trustee. That's probably how he got the gig at Southern in the first place. Now, remember, in 2003, I don't even think the Muslims, I do not know the first time where Muslims started putting up material going, there's something fishy about this, dude. I don't remember when Muhammad Khan started. I'm going to guess around 2008. I'd say it's a fairly, I think I'm being pretty fair there. I think around 2008. This is 5 years earlier than that. There was no reason for Dr. Mohler, Dr. Moore, Dr. anybody to question what this man has to say. The willingness of Ergen Kanner. Now, again, all you got to do, take the Geiser excuse sheet written by Emir Kanner. Take the Bruton Parker press release. Just use them as your standard. And Ergen Kanner stood in front of Al Mohler and the staff and the faculty and the students of Southern Seminary and boldly lied his face off with a smile. With a smile. The man is incorrigible. But here's what made it so significant to me. What turned me on to this? What got me aware of where Ergen Kanner was coming from? Of the fact there was a problem. His claims about Shabir Ali, remember? Muhammad Khan sent me, he posted a video. Well, it wasn't even a video. It's just one of those YouTube things where you have audio. But you know what I mean. 2010, I think it was February, I'm going over to London, going to do debates over there with Muslims, real debates. We can prove it because you can go watch them on YouTube today. Unlike Ergen Kanner, where you can't do any of that. And there you had, twice in 2007, Ergen Kanner claiming to have debated Shabir Ali. Now, the one thing that Ergen Kanner has apologized for in all of this, now, you know, we've seen his tweets, utterly vindicated, pure as the driven snow, I deny everything that's ever been accused of me. But the one thing that he apologized for was misnaming a particular Islamic scholar. He didn't even have the guts to say, you know what, I claimed to have debated Shabir Ali and I was wrong. I was wrong. And even then, his apology was up for, what, 10 days, 2 weeks? And then he pulled it. Then he pulled it. And yet people today still go, well, he did say, oh, and that was the other thing. Would you remind me to do this? On the Pastor's Perspective program last week, Calvary Chapel, Brian Broderson took a call about Ergun Canner and said he's repented. He's repented. I was going to play it, and I have it on my other computer, and I just forgot. I'm sorry. But he claims that Ergun Canner's repented. The only thing Ergun Canner, quote-unquote, repented of was claiming to have debated Shabir Ali. That's the only thing. Broderson is wrong. We'll play the whole call. I have it. You know what? Did I save it to Dropbox? If I was smart, I saved it to Dropbox. Let me look real quick. This is a musical interlude. Canner, cycling, Canner. I didn't. Why not? Because you're dumb. It's on my desktop at home. But I will grab it and we will listen to it because someone called in. They were given bad information. Now, again, you know, Brian Broderson just may think that's the case. But he's wrong. Here's the point. Two times in 2007, he claims to debate Shabir Ali. He's never met Shabir Ali. He's never debated Shabir Ali. Blah, 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 blah. Right? We all know that, right? Uh-huh. I was on Joe Max Road. I was eastbound on Joe Max Road when I heard this. It's beep, stuck in the brain. That part won't go away. I may forget who I am, but I will not forget where I was when I heard this. Hello, click, go.
With Shabir Ali, when he and I do debate, he will say, well, you will speak very kindly about Muhammad. And I said, as long as you do so about Jesus, you attack Jesus, I'm going after Muhammad. And so he said, that's what I did. As soon as he did.
Stone Cold Steve Austin.
Now, yeah, you can hear him say it. That's Dr. Moore. See, Dr. at the beginning of this, at the beginning of the Q&A section here, listen to what Dr. Moore says here at the beginning of the Q&A section.
Several questions that I did not anticipate being raised today that have. The first is President Mueller whispering to me, who is Stone Cold Steve Austin? The second of which.
So see, Canner mentioned Steve Austin, Stone Cold Steve Austin. The people in the audience laughed, and Mueller said, who's that? And so what you have here is Canner claims to debate Shabir Ali. Here it is again.
Big, kind, you know, language, Shabir Ali, when he and I do debate, he will say, well, you will speak very kindly about Muhammad. And I said, as long as you do so about Jesus, you attack Jesus, I'm going after Muhammad. And so he said, that's what I did. As soon as he did.
Stone Cold Steve Austin.
So that's Dr. Moore leaning over to Dr. Mueller saying, there. And you know what he's doing. You've seen Canner do. He's doing his Stone Cold Steve Austin thing. And he had even earlier, I marked it up here. Here. Right here.
Fat Stone Cold Steve Austin. I don't look religious. The fact that you know that, you've just bothered your president a lot. Yeah! I love you so much.
See, there's where it came in. So, we all know he has a WWF fantasy. He thinks he's a WWF guy, that he's one of these wrestlers. We've been told this by everybody who knows him. His basement, when he was at Liberty, was filled with full-size, life-size posters of WWF people, and he's just taken with this strange... We're not talking UFC stuff here. We're talking the goofy fake stuff. That's where he lives. And that's... So he's striking this Stone Cold Steve Austin pose. As if, well, you know, I told Shabir Ali. He's never met Shabir Ali. And this was 4 years earlier than the earliest example we had. If we had a exhaustive accounting of everything that Ergun Canner said during that time period, all the radio interviews, how many times we find him misstating things? Because remember, even in his apology, he lied. He said, I misspoke. Excuse me. This is now 4 years earlier. You going to tell me that twice in 2007 and 4 years earlier, you were just misspeaking the same name and quoting him? Now, by the way, I know Shabir Ali pretty well. He would never have said to Aaron Cantor, you need to speak respectively of Muhammad. He'd never say that. He'd never say that. And he never did, because they've never met. The man's lying through his teeth. And he's lying through his teeth on stage at Southern Seminary. And he just continued it and continued it. Why? Because he got away with it. There was nobody in that room who knew Shabir Ali. I didn't know who Shabir Ali was in 2003. I had no idea. If I had been sitting there, I would have been absolutely, wow, this guy's great. This is awesome. This guy's good. Now, the reality is now being where I am, I listen to his answers and I go, this guy is clueless. I mean, there were things that he was saying in answer to good questions that Dr. Moore asked him that are literally incoherent. They're incoherent. Listen to this.
And so, I mean, does that make sense?
It absolutely does. I had the same conflict. I was at Frankfurt at the book festival with the International Mission Board guys there, and they had said, but the only term we can use is Allah. And I made the point that, you know, what you do not have is a personal relationship. Refer to Allah as Father, there's no problem. If you want to use Allah, I would always say Isa bin Allah, Jesus, Son of God. We're in such a rush to get my people saved that we're neglecting that before one is saved, they must recognize their lostness. In other words, that Allah is not just a good path but off the wrong exit, but that Allah was idolatry. Just for me, from my perspective, most of us who are MBBs, Muslim background believers, we do not use Allah as our terminology, even in Arabic. We may use the Persian term Kudu, but if I speak of Allah, I say Isa bin Allah.
That is gibberish. That is gibberish. The standard Arabic translations of the Bible use Allah. That whole, he claimed there again to be able to speak Arabic. It's a lie. It's gibberish. What wonderful opportunity to have actually educated those students, given them something they could use, totally wasted because this guy has an ego the size of Mount Rushmore and wants to be worshipped by people. And the result is gibberish. Makes no sense. None of that made a bit of sense. He even used Isa. Why use Isa? They don't use Isa. That's a mispronunciation of Jesus' name. Well, so there you go. Proof positive that Aaron Cantor was lying about debating Shabir Ali at least 4 years earlier than our earliest documentation before. And I haven't even started playing it because we've got, well, here, just the first few seconds here because we're about out of time. Just hold on just one second.
But I was a Muslim for 20 years.
20 years? Really?
My father was an ulema.
Ulema is plural? It's an alim?
A scholar, a hadithic scholar more specifically.
A hadithic scholar. He designed mosques. He didn't have any degrees in hadith. And by the way, if this guy could speak Arabic, he would know what the term for a scholar of hadith is. It's muhadith. Muhadith, that's a scholar of hadith. Not a hadithic scholar. I mean, it's just, oh, my. My. So we're going to listen to it. Download and save to hard drives, folks, because you know what canonization does. We hope that's not going to happen here. But we've got it, and the net never forgets. And so there you go. But we will work through it because there's some. Again, he claims to have done a debate at the University of North Texas that there was an imam he was debating who he called Abi, which means father. Why in the world? What? Just it is truly amazing. But he miscites Surah 5:116. He depends on Yusuf Ali. He does the majority you know, we were always in the minority stuff. Right here.
But it was my saturation. It was my life. Everywhere I lived before I came to America, we were in the majority. I come to America, and I have to explain to you, from the Islamic mindset, it is tough moving to your culture.
Yeah, there you go. And now we all know, of course, that he came here before he was three. Again, just more evidence, you who continue to defend arrogant canter, how much will it take? Folks at Bruton Parker, think, people, think, how much evidence do you require? It is amazing, absolutely, positively amazing. So we will continue on with that, as well as watching the developments in all sorts of other areas. We will be back before the end of the year, probably do a sort of year in review type thing if we possibly can. It has been an amazing year, certainly the most amazing year in my ministry, and we'll talk about that as well. Thanks for listening to Dividing Line today, and God bless.